So bear with me. So life is full of challenges. When I was in high school, and my favorite existentialist was Camus, he said, and I still think it's a true quote, to be a human is hard, and to have a life is hard, as well as joyous. So we have all of these challenges that happen within the context of our own body and mind, right? All of the voices that are, habituated, the messages we send ourselves or that we hear from our early days. We have physical issues as we get older. Then there are external issues, relationships with families, friends, work, and the national level of things that might have several people stirred up a little bit as we approach next week. And then we have global things, Good thing we're not too in touch with other planets. We'd have them to worry about as well. And so, with practice and with recovery, we are not trying to make life other than it is. We're not trying to shape this life to be into some notion of how we think life should be, or into some sense of, life should be perfect, this shouldn't be happening. We're not struggling with that should. I mean, we do, but the invitation is to keep finding more space so that we don't have to constantly be hearing that life should be, this sort of way or that way. As though we're in a sumo match with it, or constantly arm wrestling with life as it is. So we talk about this from recovery from the vantage point of life on life's terms, right? And we talk about it from a Buddhist perspective, and particularly in this lineage that I'm part of, Suzuki Roshi, where he said, things just as they are, things just as they are. So practice and recovery are about how can we come into an upright and a wholesome relationship with life. As it is, just as it is, with clear eyes and with a soft, wide open heart and with calm abiding. And in a way that always leaves room for joy and happiness, genuine joy and happiness. How do we get there? Well, I think the first thing that we need, and that what happens to us both in recovery and practice, is that we start to have awareness of our suffering, right? We admit that we are powerless. Oh my God, yet again, I have emptied a carton of vanilla bean ice cream, or eaten, olive bread, or whatever the substance is, gone back to that so-and-so person. So we get to see, have an awareness of what are the causes and conditions of our suffering, and be they substances, be they ideas, the habitual ideas constantly here, particularly I think for people in recovery of, the not ever being good enough, the low self-esteem, or ideas like life is unfair. Fear that comes up. Just all of those things that are kind of mental and emotional habit energies. So we start to become aware of what it is that's blocking our happiness, accessing our happiness, our joy, our sense of ease in the world. What do we stub our toe on that constantly causes our suffering? And then, we start to make an effort to implement change, having awakened, coming to an awareness of things are, we start to really change. We start to stop drinking, stop smoking dope, stop eating compulsively, stop getting into bad relationships, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But this is what we do. We move into action, and we move into applying effort. To try and change that initial behavior, to really push back against it. And it's a strong habit energy, so it requires a lot of a lot of effort, a lot of patience, a lot of loving kindness on our part, because particularly all of those things that are internalized have a pretty long shelf life. They can take a long time to wear out, to let go of. I love, I might have said this before, but one of my favorite things that Joko Beck used to say is that she didn't think we ever let go of things. She thought we just wore them out. And that's kind of been my experience. It's like those ideas of not being good enough, of fear, just really focusing attention. We just keep wearing them out. At any rate, it takes effort, and we with awareness and with a commitment to this, we start to put our shoulder metaphorically into the wheel of all of this to try and change things. And we know how to do this because we've done this with in sobriety and in abstinence, right? We've learned how to change very often a physical habit of drinking, taking the joint, whatever, taking the food, and we don't do that. Things inside can be more subtle and more persistent, as I said, but I think we all need to take great faith and great confidence that our recovery program gives us a real leg up in terms of once we start to work with the things beyond the physical aspects, the physical substances that cause that are the cause of our addictive behavior. So I think both recovery and Buddhist practice really give us some important mind-body training, right? We learn how to train our body not to do this or that, right? Or to ingest something. We start working with our stinking thinking by working with slogans, by working with sponsors, by listening to the literature, by identifying with people and the various forms of our meetings, shares or AWOLs or whatever we are at the heart of our program. And this all helps to cultivate mindfulness. Mindfulness is not outside of our bodies. Mindfulness is in here. We already have it. We just like sobriety and abstinence are in us, we just have to activate it and then work on growing it and deepening it and letting it really take root. And every time we make an effort, every time, it's just like recovery. I mean, I got to be almost 38 years of recovery by just every day making the effort of saying no, creating the mindfulness and the muscle behind that. And as we turn toward other things that cause us suffering, that are challenging in our lives, that are either persistent long-term types of things or more immediate, you know, getting bad health news, dealing with family members who are suddenly become sick and become our responsibility, having company come and stay for a eternity, whatever it is, right? Mindfulness works. We're practicing everywhere, and the all of our efforts, you know, the time that we meditate here, the time that we pay attention, just, you know, while we're driving in a car, being aware that I'm breathing in, breathing out, when we hit a pause button, all of that is cultivating more mindfulness, more positive energy, more positive habit inclinations, and help us to transform, as we've seen already, our addictive behaviors. So this allows us to more and more learn how to reside in steady, wholesome states of mind and heart. And that's where I think the real transformation of recovery and of practice come from, by being able to locate ourselves and stay for longer and longer in wholesome states of mind and heart, right? As opposed to be distracted by everything that's going on, or being imprisoned or led around by all of the previous very negative habit energy that was so reactive, right? Life is not fair, I'm terrible, you're terrible, whatever our particular default ideas of heart and mind are. So these states of mind tend to be very fixed and very hard, and they're really painful. I mean, certainly I don't experience my heart and my mind this way anymore, thankfully, after 38 years of recovery and 36, 37 of practice, but they don't go away entirely. And when I do experience them, they're very painful. And I remember very acutely in prior to coming into recovery and practice and in early recovery and practice, exactly how painful these states of mind and heart can be that do tend to be the habit energy, the messages that tell us that we're not good enough or life is not fair or that there's not enough for us or whatever, life is not safe. So this is referred to, I like this image from a Buddhist perspective, whether it is an idea or whether it's the particular language, whether it's an emotion, it's called the snare of these various thoughts, reactions, ideas that puts a straitjacket on the situations of our lives. And that image immediately, you know, summons up for me a very specific idea of how I restrain. I find myself in a situation or with a person or with an idea, and suddenly it's very, very small. Suddenly I'm totally constricted by my idea. And that's exactly what has happened, is that these habit energies have come up, these habit patterns of mind and heart have come up to describe my situation, probably in a way that was true in the past, but really doesn't have to be true in the present. But again, they're very, very powerful. So the other way we talk about this, which is just another beautiful Buddhist metaphor, it's looking at the sky through a bamboo shoot, right? Which is to say that much the way you feel small and constricted with a straitjacket, here's the vast endless sky of possibilities, but habit energy has us looking through something with just through a narrow straw. We only see it this way because we're just so propelled and fueled by the habit energy, the behavior, right? The default thing. So we, in our practice and our recovery, we work at this in terms of initially through our minds, but ultimately through our whole hearts and bodies, the whole totality of our beings, heart, mind, and body. And I think that in this area of when we are on the verge of feeling like we are about to be or we have become ensnared, that really what is most helpful, to me at least, is not so much an idea that comes up, although certainly sometimes slogans, both from recovery, lines from recovery, from practice are very helpful. But what I think is really long-term, longitudinally of help, is really being able to feel our recovery, to feel that we are in process, that we are recovering over pot or drugs or alcohol or food or relationships or bad spending or whatever it is, to feel the changes in our body and to feel this sense of practice, of mindfulness, this desire to be awake as women roaming this world and living these lives that we hope will be fulfilling and will be wholehearted and will be wholesome. To settle into what we already possess. And this is where I think I probably always say this, this is one of the things I love best about Buddhist practice. Like Suzuki Roshi always saying, this is the most important thing. But what I do love is that, you know, in Buddhist practice, there's no going out and having to acquire anything. It's not a process of addition. We already are and have everything we need. I was raised in a particular religion where it told me I was born with a black mark on my soul. I was defective. I was bad news from the get-go, and I had to be cleansed. Buddhism doesn't do that, right? And I think many of us carry around that message, whether you were in the same religious affiliation that I was in or not. Many times growing up in the karmic crucible of our families that we grew up in, we got lots of messages that felt like, you know, stains on our soul, tainting our nature, right? But Buddhism says, no, that's not the way it is at all. We all have Buddha nature. We're already perfect as we are. We just need some improvement. We need some effort. We have to, like recovery, where we are recovering our wholehearted, wholesome, sober, abstinent natures, you know, as people in Buddhist practice, we are returning to who we already are, right? And so it's more a process of subtraction rather than having to go out and to add anything on. There's don't have to become a perfect practitioner, don't have to be a perfect little girl or an older woman or a middle-aged woman. Just have to be in alignment with who we truly are. So I wanted to bring up in this context something that I think is very helpful. That's a Buddhist teaching, and many of you probably already know it. It's alternately called, or variously called, the Brahma Viharas. The dwelling place of the Brahmas, or the divine beings. It's called the divine abodes, the four immeasurables, or sublime attitudes, and there are probably other names for it as well. Who's familiar with these? Jenny, I bet you are. Yeah.
Leslie. Can you repeat that, Cynthia? What did you say?
They're called Brahma Viharas, and I can spell that for you later, if you'd like, the divine abodes, or the four measurables, or the sublime attitudes. And they consist of, and I like this last one, the sublime attitudes, because as opposed to a quick emotion, right, that I might feel, that feels a little bit more ephemeral, you know, establishing an attitude, like we talk about in recovery, an attitude of gratitude. That's been established in me, right? I have that attitude of gratitude. It's something it's more lasting that can really be embedded in us. So it's not kind of on the surface and fleeting, the way emotions can come and go or thoughts can come and go. You know, working the way we work to overcome stinking thinking, to develop a new attitude. We will develop a new attitude. What is that, in the steps or is that in the promises? I'm forgetting right now. So our recovery program is inviting us to do this as well. So there are four elements of the Brahma Viharas. The first is one that we're all familiar with, which is metta, or loving kindness or goodwill. You know, at the end of all of our MIR meetings, we dedicate the merit and we offer that metta. May all beings be free from pain and suffering. May all beings be healed, whole, and happy. That is the statement or the little prayer that is configured in many different ways to express loving kindness or goodwill. That's metta. Karuna is compassion, and mudita is appreciative or empathetic joy. And the thinking or the design here is that when you establish an attitude of goodwill, of loving kindness towards yourself, all of this begins at home, and then extend it out toward others, then compassion and empathetic joy or appreciative joy kind of follow naturally. Oh, gosh. You know, I have goodwill, and because of that, you know, I'm really appreciative that Janine has to go to those board meetings, and they've got to be hard, and they're a big practice place for her. Or I'm really, really happy that Maria's practice period with her visiting company is over, you know. Or I'm really happy that that person in front of me got the winning lotto ticket for the $1 billion jackpot. Sympathetic joy, appreciative joy. So those things flow naturally out of the sense of goodwill. The last one is upekkha, or equanimity. Equanimity meaning tranquility, evenness, stability. So what I'd like to do, it kind of provides the ground. Like I always get a sense of ground. I can be equanimous and I can have this ground of equanimity to stand on in terms of how I approach my life. So what I'd like to do right now is just to take us through this very briefly for just metta and for equanimity. And the mechanics, as many of you know who have done this, is that, as I said, this all starts at home with us. So the first thing we do is we offer loving kindness or the wish for equanimity to ourselves. And then we offer it to somebody that we love, that we care for, where it's very easy to immediately wish them well as well. No problem. Immediately, they just jump into your mind. And then the third piece is that you want to find somebody who's either a little bit more challenging, or that person next to you at work who slurps their coffee, or, you know, the person on the bus or whatever, maybe the relative who occasionally comes to visit, who's, and then you want to move to a very difficult person, right? So we start with ourselves. We move to somebody we love. We move to somebody who's a little more challenging or even neutral. And then we move to offering this to somebody who is a real challenge to us. What we refer to as our spiritual friends, the ones who really make us work our programs and our practice. And in doing this, we are, one of the benefits is that that we just keep increasing our capacity to hold in a steady way, that steady attitude, a spirit of goodwill for all sorts of people under all circumstances. Ourselves, which often can be the hardest practice, the one we love, probably not so hard. Someone who's a little bit more difficult, maybe a little wobbly, but then the real, you know, master's class is for the person who works our last nerve. This is praying for the person who really troubles us, right? Which is what we talk about in recovery programs about doing. So we're just going to take maybe about 4 or 5 minutes to do this. And what I'd really like you to focus on, just to, you know, close your eyes, relax, nothing to see or do, just listen to my voice. And I'm going to put a little bit of space in between the elements for loving kindness and for equanimity. And I just ask that you see, pay attention less to the idea of it and more to the feeling of it, to see if you can actually sink into experiences of loving kindness, to sink into experiences of equanimity. So please make yourself comfortable. And as I said, you might just want to close your eyes. That's fine. May I be free from pain and suffering. May I be healed, whole, and happy. May I know the joy of my true nature. May I live with peace and ease and safety. Now conjuring somebody you love, may they be free from pain and suffering. May they be healed, whole, and happy. May they know the joy of their true nature. May they live with peace and ease and safety. And now conjuring someone who's a little difficult or perhaps neutral. Though finding someone we feel neutral about is generally a hard task. May they be free from pain and suffering. May they be healed, whole, and happy. May they know the joy of their true nature. May they live with peace and ease and safety. And now bringing to mind someone who is very difficult, who is a challenge for you. May they be free from pain and suffering. May they be healed, whole, and happy. May they know the joy of their true nature. May they live in peace and ease with safety. And now returning to yourself, may I have equanimity. May I abide in tranquility. May I deeply know calm abiding. And bringing forth someone you love. May they have equanimity. May they know deep tranquility. May they reside in calm abiding. And now bringing forth someone who is a little more challenging for you, or neutral. May they have equanimity. May they know deep tranquility. May they reside in calm abiding. And now to someone who is very challenging and difficult. May they know equanimity. May they know deep tranquility. May they reside in calm abiding. I think that this practice really helps when we are troubled, either, as I said, by internal causes and conditions, by those close to us in family, relationship, work, or on a larger scale, as we look at some of the very significant challenges that face us in this lifetime. So it is not in any way to deny or to develop a different perspective, a rose-colored glass, if you will. But I think that what this process allows us to do is to first and foremost quiet our heart and our mind and our body. There's something very inherently peaceful about going through the Brahma Viharas. I think that it also, my experience is that it opens the space, right? It softens and opens the space of my heart and mind. I was thinking about the person who actually is not the most difficult person, but someone who I find difficult. And I actually felt my heart kind of starting to well up a little bit with compassion for this person and think, beyond my reaction of that person is so annoying to, I think that person's life is hard. I think they've got some challenges that they're dealing with, right? So it opens us up to a different lenses or seeing beyond the straw, looking at the sky, not putting the straitjacket on our experience or ideas. And for me, there's something energetically about doing this which helps to cleanse my own heart, mind, and body and kind of reset it from, you know, if I'm buzzing along with a lot of attitudes and different feelings, to really just do a reset. Kind of the way I find going to a meeting is very helpful in terms of providing a reset. You know, take a few deep breaths, come into alignment, remember the message, be in the solution, or sitting meditation provides that same reset. And it opens me up consciously and unconsciously to other beneficial ways of being in relation to particularly the difficult people or the people that are really, really challenging that I find, to wish them so deeply and truly. And I forgot to add a final statement to the meditation, which is this. And if I cannot do this now in the present, may I be able to do it at some point in the future, right? So if there's somebody, and certainly, you know, people that are unsafe, whatever, we don't want to, it's not about making a spiritual bypass and, you know, trying to join hands and sing kumbaya and put ourselves in danger or make things be other than what they are. But it is about trying to slowly open up the heart so that, again, if I can't do it now, may I be able to offer this person loving kindness at some point in the future. That's all. I can't do it now, but may I? So it sets the intention, and the power of intention is really, really extraordinary. Something happens over time when we keep repeating and embedding our intention to reside in these twining programs, which have us living the 12 out of a 12 step and doing no harm, right? That's the request ultimately when we get to the treasure. So, and then I think that the other thing that for me that they allow me to do is, you know, while turning to a book can sometimes be helpful, and I do it very often, having lived over up here for X number of decades, There's something that is more somatically helpful to me by just sinking into a more simple, streamlined type of exercise that really helps me to calm and bring my heart, mind, and body into alignment, to open it up a little bit and to feel some different type of energy and intention coming forward, to bring it, request it to come forward, to actually feel it respond and to come forward in my body. So I'm reminded of the line in the 12 and 12 somewhere where it says, you know, this is a program that works under all conditions. And I think that's equally true of practice, that we are, you know, exposed to elements of practice and mindfulness that if we remember to embody them and to use them, really is helpful under virtually all conditions of our lives. So when we're feeling that we're really confronted by and going toe-to-toe with the challenges that are genuine in our lives, that there are ways that we can introduce different energy, we can make more space, we can soothe our hearts and our minds and bodies, and we can pivot so that it's not so much a punitive experience as rather than, you know, let me put out a good intention here, that that loving kindness and equanimity pervade both for me as well as for the challenging situation. You know, one of my favorite quotes all time is from Viktor Frankl, who I'm sure most of you know was a Holocaust survivor and went on to become a psychologist. And he says, having survived the Holocaust, this is, I think, perhaps the most famous quote of his: between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. That's such a good quote, I'm going to read it again. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lives our growth and our freedom. And I really think that this is what recovery and what practice allow us to do. You know, the 12 and 12 in the big book are rife with the word pause. We learn to pause, we learn to create space. And in Buddhist practice, there are many, many techniques, be it sitting zazen, being at chanting, being at the loving kindness meditation, the Brahma Viharas, that are helpful to actually get us to introduce into an otherwise charged, flaring, wires flapping type of situation, some space. And in that space, with calm, with loving kindness, and with a sense of equanimity, we can choose a response that is ultimately more beneficial for us and ultimately more beneficial for others. So I think that that is probably all that I want to say, except that somewhere along the line, in thinking about this, I came across a quote that I can't attribute, but I loved it, which is that we are the architects of our own happiness. So life is life. It's not about making life perfect. It's about getting out of that wrestling match mentality and mode with life and learning to live in a broader and bigger way, and learning and trusting that we can find ways under all conditions, whatever our challenges and difficulties might be, personal, national, global, whatever, intergalactic. I have faith that it would even work when we get into our space machines, when we get into our, instead of buying our Teslas, we buy our SpaceX machine and we go elsewhere, even under those conditions, wherever we go, that these are two wonderful practices that we're gifted with that really do work under all conditions. So thank you kindly for your attention.